Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Jason Howell and I sit down to talk to some great folks about some interesting topics. First, we've got Sam Kessler from CoinDesk, who's joining us to talk about this whole Jack Dorsey Web 5 thing. We get the math, 3 plus 2 equals 5, but what is Web 5? And was Jack Dorsey being serious? Then we talk to Lizzie Lawrence of Protocol about Meta and Instagram working to make it so that you get off the platforms and don't spend too much time on Instagram. But will these changes actually click for people, and will they take some time away? Then we talk about some really interesting legislation working its way through the system here in the United States for a change in the way that companies are allowed to handle our location data. Perhaps it's not a good idea for them to be able to sell our location data. Before we round things out with a look at Activision Blizzard's lawsuit, and Activision says, look, there's no systemic issue with harassment here. So stay tuned for Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 239, recorded Thursday, June 16th, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Cisco Meraki. With employees working in different locations, providing a unified work experience seems as easy as herding cats. How do you rein in so many moving parts? Well, the Meraki Cloud Managed Network. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit.
And by Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat discussing tech topics big, small, and strange. Listen to Compiler on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to podcasts.
And by Melissa. Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal. It's easy to log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records cleaned for free at melissa.com/twit.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And I'm the other guy, Jason Howell. Are you comfortable with Web 3 right now?
I feel very safe in Web 1.
Okay, so you're a few steps behind.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay. I don't need a number increase, but
but here we are.
Okay, it's fine.
This is where we are today. Apparently, even Web 3 isn't good enough, according to Jack Dorsey, former Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, but also now currently with Block. And we've got Web 5 to talk about, because apparently this is the thing. But is he serious? I think that's the really big question here. Like, how much of this is serious? How much of this is tongue-in-cheek, like a statement piece? Joining us to break this all down is Sam Kessler, news reporter for CoinDesk. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Micah.
Absolutely. It's great to get you on today. Thank you for carving out a few minutes to talk to us about Web 5 and all of this. I don't know. At first, is it serious? Is it wacky? I don't know what to call it at this point. But let's start with the details, because Dorsey released kind of a slide deck to illustrate. And I say illustrate because it's very illustrated. It's very like pretty with bright, flashy colors and everything to illustrate what Web 5 actually is or is supposedly. So if you had to describe Web 5, how would you describe that?
Yeah, it's a good question. First off, I'm glad you kind of prefaced this by saying it might be a joke. I want to say for the record, like if people look at this in 10 years time and Web 5 is not a thing and it was supposed to be a joke, like we're mindful of that. Maybe this is all a joke. I will talk about why he would want to make the joke. But anyway, what is Web 5? Web 3 is this idea where, you know, we have, instead of intermediaries that control how we communicate with one another, so instead of there being like a Google, an Amazon, a Facebook kind of in the middle, people in a Web 3 system and now in this Web 5 system, which is a little bit different, are able to communicate with one another kind of directly, but without, you know, putting their data through these, you know, third parties that can own it themselves and then profit as a result. So Web 3 builds this based on blockchains like Ethereum, smart contracts, all that kind of stuff that you can honestly Google after this and try to get really deep into. Web 5 is the idea that all of that is worth ignoring for some reasons we can talk about. And instead, it should be built on both Bitcoin and a bunch of computer science and web tools and frameworks that have already existed for years and years and years. It's kind of Jack Dorsey's FU to this whole Web3 system that we've seen come up.
Yeah, and certainly not the first time that we've known that Dorsey, you know, has, I don't know, maybe it's a love-hate relationship with Web3, because on one hand, he's sold on the on a lot of the concepts behind what drives Web3, but Web3 as, you know, as a thing, he has been very vocal about kind of being a naysayer about it specifically. So then why is Jack Dorsey talking about all of this right now, as people are getting comfortable with Web3? And actually, I say that, I think there's still a lot of confusion widely about what Web3 actually is. So then why should there, or potentially should there, if this is at all serious, be a Web5 right here, right now?
Right now. So there's a couple of reasons why he might be doing it now. If it is a troll, he chose a good time to do it. He did it. So CoinDesk, the company that I write for, we have a big conference every year called Consensus that gathers a bunch of people from blockchain and crypto, you know, all across the industry. They announced it there. And I think it was supposed to kind of be a contrast to a lot of these Web3 things that we were seeing at that conference and a lot of the news and announcements that were coming out around it. So that's a reason why now. Another thing is, okay, we see Ethereum and decentralized finance, NFTs, a lot of these things that people have been super hyped about for the past, you know, couple of years. We've had this huge bull market. A lot of that stuff is crashing, and the principles behind it, these fundamentals, if you want to call them that, are coming into question. They're coming under fire, as we've seen token prices, NFTs all kind of tank. And so I think if this was a troll, and even if it wasn't a troll, this is kind of a good time to come out with this sort of alternate vision for both Web3 and Web5, but also for crypto, by basing things on Bitcoin, which is this idea of a global, you know, reserve currency, a gold, like the digital gold, rather than Ethereum, smart contracts and fancy technology that, you know, Jack Dorsey thinks is all kind of a sideshow, basically, when you look at Bitcoin.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned kind of the timing of this being announced with the conference and everything, which means a lot of people who actually have a lot of interest in these topics, both tangentially and directly. What has been the consensus around this from people who are full, like all in on these concepts, on Bitcoin, on, you know, Web3 as a, you know, as a platform, as a, as an ethos for the future of the internet? Are they, because I will say that a lot of what I read about this prior didn't really seem to allude to this idea that, oh, well, maybe he's just playing with us. You know, maybe he's making a joke. A lot of it was very much like, well, let's try and understand this. So if it's a joke, yeah, like how are the people who are really invested in this, how are they taking this?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. So I'm hedging a little bit by saying it's a joke. Like, there are real technologies that they're bringing up behind the scenes that could make this work. Sure. And I honestly don't have like a positive or negative feeling on one side or the other. I'm pretty curious if they can build it to see what happens. It's open source, meaning members of the community, a broader community, can help and contribute. So that out of the way. Talking about how people are receiving it requires us to think, viewers might be aware of this, it requires kind of a dive into the ethos around crypto in general. Yeah. And the fact that there are camps. There's like Bitcoin maximalists, people like Jack Dorsey, who think that Bitcoin is the be all end all, in end all rather. And then you, of course, you have the Ethereum maximalists who think that's the best chain. You have, you know, all different kinds of chains, Cosmos, Polkadot. People think that their chain is the best. Most people sit somewhere in between. Jack Dorsey is not one of those people. And a lot of people who are in that Jack Dorsey Bitcoin maximalist camp are really excited about this vision of a Web5 that is built more on the foundations of Bitcoin and other technologies than Ethereum. But the other thing that I'll say, you know, with all of this in mind, is that a lot of people are also looking at this whole Web5 thing, even if it's not a joke, as something interesting not only because of what it is, but because of what it stands in contrast to, which is Web3. Web3 is this idea of this decentralized internet, like I was talking about before, where people communicate without intermediaries, they control their own data, yada, yada, yada. But Jack Dorsey has a point that a lot of people agree with him on, which is that big venture firms, big companies, Andreessen Horowitz's of the world, A16Z, people like that have, you know, sweeped up a lot of these companies that are going to, in Dorsey's view and some other people's view, centralize power in this Web3 system, just in the same way things were centralized before, like today in Web2, as we call it.
Yeah, and no question, someone like Jack Dorsey, like if just some random person came out and said, hey, I've got an idea for a new web, it's called Web 5. I mean, there's a possibility that it would get some traction. There's a possibility that it would get some attention. But you have someone who is so well known for a number of different reasons, and especially in the Web 3 crypto Bitcoin community, as Jack Dorsey announcing this, whether it's a joke or not, there's going to be some seriousness to look into it and say, well, wait a minute, you're a pretty smart guy. Like, what is this future? Let's think this out. And so regardless, this is going to be talked about, whether he intended for that or not. I have a feeling he probably intended for that. But what is the rationale between from jumping from Web 3 directly to Web 5? Is this just semantics? Is there a joke behind that? What's that all about?
Yeah, I mean, I covered this at Consensus at the conference. And when I got there, the person who announced it, who is the lead of TBD, which is the crypto subsidiary, the Bitcoin subsidiary of Block, Dorsey's company, he dressed up in kind of like a jumpsuit with like the number 5 right on his chest, sunglasses. Wow. It was like a whole thing. So, you know, all that aside, and he said, and I quote this in my piece, he said, you know, one of the great things about Web 5 is that it's two better than Web 3. So I think part of this is just tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
It is really clever marketing. But, you know, Web 2 plus Web 3 equals Web 5. Maybe that is a interesting, good point. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it goes up to 11, right? You turn it up to 11.
Can't go past that.
Yeah. I'm guessing the answer is no here, but something that kind of comes up for me as we continue to talk about decentralization and especially Jack Dorsey, realizing that Dorsey is no longer with Twitter. But is there any sort of like could you imagine any sort of connection for Dorsey drawing the lines between his efforts at Twitter with Blue Sky and kind of what's going on here? Are they completely disparate, separate things in your mind?
It's hard to say for certain. The relationship between TBD and Block is also kind of weird. Like Block itself, Jack Dorsey's company, has a Bitcoin-focused branch within it. But then TBD is more this experiment ground. And they've had other projects before that have yet to, you know, come out. I think that there is like real, you know, there are real engineers working on these problems, and it's open source. Like I said, anybody can, you know, also work on these same problems themselves and contribute. I think part of the point here is to create a larger, broader effort to rally people around Bitcoin, which Dorsey believes in, rather than these other technologies. And so this is, I see it as much of it is like an engineering effort. It's also a marketing effort in comparison to his other ventures.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of sense. Well, Sam, really appreciate you taking time to talk with us all about Web 5. And I guess we'll probably be talking about it more. That's my big question mark. Yeah. And we'll certainly see. Sam Kessler writes, of course, for CoinDesk. Thank you so much for hopping on today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Micah.
All right. We'll talk with you soon. Up next, Instagram is doing that thing where they put a few speed bumps into your experience to slow down users, to get them to take a break, you know, all the protect the users essentially. But how effective will it be? We're going to talk about that coming up. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Cisco Meraki, the experts in cloud-based networking for hybrid work. So if you've got employees who are working at home, maybe even a cabin in the mountains, because we can do that now very easily, a lot easier anyways than we could before. On a lounge chair at the beach, a cloud-managed network provides the same exceptional work experience no matter where they are, right? Because it's in the cloud. You may as well roll out the welcome mat because hybrid work is here to stay, like it or not. Hybrid work works best in the cloud, actually, and has its perks for both employees and leaders. Workers can move faster. They can deliver better results with a cloud-managed network. And leaders can automate distributed operations. They can build more sustainable workspaces and proactively protect the network. An IDG MarketPulse research report conducted for Meraki highlights top-tier opportunities in supporting hybrid work. Hybrid work, it's a priority for 78% of C-suite executives. Leaders want to drive collaboration forward, of course, while also staying on top of or actually boosting productivity and security. Hybrid work also has its challenges. The IDG report raises the red flag about security. It notes that 48% of leaders report cybersecurity threats as a primary obstacle to improving workforce experiences. Always-on security monitoring is just part of what makes the cloud-managed network so awesome. IT can use apps from Meraki's vast ecosystem of partners. These are turnkey solutions that are built to work seamlessly with the Meraki cloud platform. So you can, you know, get things like asset tracking, location analytics, and a whole lot more. You can also gather insights on how people use their workspaces in a smart space. Environmental sensors can actually track activity and occupancy levels to stay on top of cleanliness. You can reserve workspaces. So based on vacancy, based on employee profiles, also called hot desking, that allows employees to scout out the spot in a snap. Locations in restricted environments can be booked in advance and include time-based door access. And then mobile device management. This is integrating devices and systems to allow IT to manage, update, and troubleshoot company-owned devices, even when that device or that employee are in a remote location, which is exactly what we're talking about here. Turn any space into a place of productivity. Empower your organization with the same exceptional experience, no matter where they work, because right now they're working everywhere with Meraki and the Cisco suite of technology. You can learn how your organization can make hybrid work by visiting meraki.cisco.com/twit. And I'll spell that out, M-E-R-A-K-I, meraki.cisco.com/twit. And we thank Meraki and Cisco for their support of Tech News Weekly.
All right, we are back from the break, and that means it is time for my story. This is one of those situations where we've seen different companies try to tackle this in different ways. People themselves try to tackle it in different ways. It's all about trying to find a method to get folks to maybe take a break. Joining us today to talk about Meta's efforts in this field is Protocol's own Lizzie Lawrence. Welcome back to the show, Lizzie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yes, we are so great. It's so great to get you here. And today we're talking about Instagram in particular. So Instagram is a long-lived app that, of course, was acquired by Meta and since then has faced some different investigations, a number of lawsuits, all sorts of stuff. And in at least an outward attempt to appear as if they are trying to make a difference, they've been working on tools for a long time to help people limit their time on the platform. I was hoping you could kind of talk about the history of the changes that have taken place thus far before we dig into the most recent updates on the platform.
Absolutely. So in the wake of the Facebook papers in late 2021, a large part of that was obviously the harms that Meta and its platforms can do to children. So a few months after that, or possibly immediately after that, Instagram paused their controversial Instagram Kids project, which was essentially going to be a separate Instagram app for kids, and for obvious reasons was pretty controversial. So after scrapping that, they instead decided to focus on parental supervision tools and time management tools in the existing Instagram app. So around November 2021, Adam Mosseri announced Take a Break, which is basically a nudge that encourages users to get off the app. That was announced as an opt-in feature in November, and it was for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or 30 minutes. TechCrunch found that in the months in between, in the months when Take a Break was still opt-in, Instagram quietly removed the 10 and 20 minute options, which is interesting.
Wow.
And then in March, Instagram officially launched Take a Break, and as well as some other parental controls, including setting screen limits and, you know, parents getting notified about their kids' activity in the app.
Yeah, when we look at the long history of Instagram, back in my day, there was a time when the timeline on Instagram was a reverse chronological feed. I would see from the accounts that I followed, they would post that day and I could see the most recent thing and then scroll back and see all the day's posts. And at some point, Instagram changed it so that it would show you content based on some, you know, behind the scenes algorithm, perhaps what you've liked before, what you pay attention to, but also what posts that you follow are getting the most attention, and then started injecting suggestions and all those kinds of things. And so this was one side of it. This was Instagram at a time seeing that it wanted more daily active users and seeing that the reverse chronological timeline ran contrary to that, because you'd open up Instagram at the beginning of the day or maybe midday, you'd see all of the Instagram posts, and then you'd open it up maybe at night and nobody had posted since then. So then you'd leave the app. So they wanted you to be in the app more often. So they started to roll out all of these changes to bring you back so that every time you opened up Instagram, there was new stuff to scroll through. And then they added these tools that are like, okay, now let's have you take a break. So we've successfully got you into the app. We've got you sort of locked in. Now we're trying to find a way to limit it. I mean, is the response here, is this a way for the company to protect itself from, in your opinion, is this a way for the company to protect itself from lawsuits? Is it the company, you know, after a difference in pattern because they feel like it's their responsibility? I'm just curious kind of the reactionary nature of these features, where in the long history we think this is coming from.
Right. So, yeah, so the timing makes you think. I mean, Meta is right now facing pressure from all sides to implement these kinds of features. I know in the last week, there were 8 lawsuits, and there's more to come, kind of coming from lawyers representing parents across the country who are basically alleging that Meta is knowingly hooked kids on these platforms and then, you know, harmed them with these algorithms and these rabbit holes leading to kind of toxic content. So, I mean, when I spoke to Instagram, you know, they referenced some of, you know, they participated in kind of anti-cyberbullying efforts and they've had some features around that. That was in 2019. But it does, I mean, it's clear that the biggest push has been recently, kind of amidst all of this, all of these concerns and pressure. So, I mean, when I asked Dana Gilbert, the head of global policy programs in Instagram, you know, about the inherent incentive to keep as many users on the app for as long as possible, and how that's been, you know, an essential part of their, you know, business, in their business interest. And she said, well, you know, it's also in our business interest to protect our users and, you know, implement these tools to keep teens safe. So, you know, it depends on who you ask.
Yeah, that makes sense. And very, I mean, that's very clearly true. If you have a subset of users who are harmed by the platform and therefore leave the platform, then yeah, you suddenly don't have those users. And if you want, you know, lifetime users, then it does make sense. So I can see the argument for sure that them working to improve this is about making it the best experience for the user. So what is the, because again, Instagram's kind of always updating things. What is the absolute latest update that's taken place to help people manage their time on the platform?
Right. So there are a bunch of sort of more incremental, smaller updates that they've done. But the two big ones are they've extended the Take a Break feature to Reels, you know, TikTok's competitor basically with the scrolling videos. And they've partnered with creators who are, after 20 minutes of scrolling in Reels, a creator might pop up and introduce you to the take a break feature. So it's not actually the feature itself. It's more introducing the feature and encouraging users to turn the feature on. And then the other big one has to do with the algorithm and is really the feature update that's most directly addressing child safety advocates' concerns, which is after in the Instagram Explore page, after a certain period of time, if a user is dwelling on one topic for what seems like an unhealthily or a long period of time, Instagram will nudge the user to switch to a different topic. Mm. And the topics exclude categories that are associated with appearance comparison. So like fitness content or celebrity content.
Okay. Now this, of course, I've scrolled through TikTok and after, you know, looking through it for a little while, somebody will pop up, a person will pop up and say, hey, you know, you might want to take a break. This is a good time to step by. So this seems like a really good opportunity. Or Instagram saw that this was a really good idea and is trying to do that as well. But I'm curious, what do experts say about this method of using creators who, you know, maybe are more in line with the kids and what the kids are saying? Does this actually work in practice? Do we know if it works in practice? Is there skepticism about whether this will work? And do people take breaks?
Yeah. So they're divided. I also, I've seen those take a break nudges pop up on my TikTok as well. Something interesting about that is I think some of these creators on TikTok became memes actually. And like I saw a Reddit post kind of poking fun. Anecdotally in my own case, my own psychology, when those nudges on TikTok would show up, I was a little bit like, don't tell me what to do.
Right, swipe past it. Like, totally. Please, yeah. I've got things to do, which is looking at TikTok like, even more.
Exactly. So I can't say that's everyone's case, but some of the experts I talked to did kind of mention the difficulty in an anti-Instagram message coming from Instagram itself, because there have been very successful like public health campaigns. Megan Moreno, one of the experts I talked to, mentioned the Truth campaign, the anti-smoking vaping campaign, which sort of frames it as a rebellious thing to not vape or like a cool thing to not vape. But it's, you know, that's not coming from vaping companies. It's like an entirely separate entity. So having, even though these are creators who are not Instagram, it's on Instagram. Mm-hmm. So it's a little difficult. It's unclear. We're not sure, I guess, how exactly teens will respond to this.
Yeah, that makes sense. In context, it is, your brain might associate that with the same thing. So to have it come from a different place entirely, maybe we'll sort of get past that filter of like that autonomy filter almost. But again, I'm sure that's research that folks have to do. Now, this is, of course, one factor is this idea of being on Instagram for too long and maybe going down a rabbit hole. But the other big thing, and we've talked about it on this show in general before, is social media addiction. And that is, there's a California law that is a bill that was aimed at sort of quelling social media addiction by giving parents the ability to sue social media companies for getting them addicted to these platforms. Has Instagram and Meta done anything to address the concerns of social media addiction, which I think it's important to separate in this context from the doom scrolling, which is one sort of underlying factor of addiction? Even if you're only on the platform for a few minutes instead of, 30 minutes, in that time, that addiction cycle may take place. So what is Instagram doing about that, if anything, or do they have any kind of future goals with that?
Yeah. So in terms of addiction and getting at that root cause, it doesn't seem to me like these features are explicitly addressing that. I asked more specifically about that and about, the algorithm kind of feeding addiction and the things they're thinking about with that. And they pointed me to this feature that I mentioned, which is pulling kids out of rabbit holes and introducing them to a new topic. So that is a really big concern. And another expert I reached out to also expressed, she said that for teens who are not already addicted, some of these features might be really effective. But if you're already, you know, if you're already addicted, it's a part of your routine to spend just copious amounts of time on Instagram. It might not work as well, kind of for the reasons we mentioned, where, you know, you want to keep scrolling. And if Instagram themselves is like, hey, maybe you should stop, that might be more of an incentive to actually continue. So that's definitely remains a big issue, and it'll be interesting to see how you know, these lawsuits and pressure, explicitly mentioning addiction, will pressure Instagram to make changes to the platform.
And the last question I'll ask you, and you kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, I'm curious kind of your own thoughts on digital time management tools. I know for me, there's a feature that Apple provides called Screen Time. And with Screen Time, you can set limits on individual apps, but also categories of apps and how much access you have to your device. And then at some point, then it will pop up and say, hey, you know, you've used up all of your time. I ended up turning that feature off because it just got on my nerves. Is there any thoughts that you have on digital time management tools? Do they work for you?
Unfortunately, I'm a bit stubborn, so they don't really work for me. As a productivity reporter, I do like trying a bunch of things, and at least in the beginning, if I turn on screen reminders or I used the Pomodoro method for a while, which is like which is very helpful, and it would turn on that I would actually get notifications on when to stop work. But I mean, after a little bit, I get used to ignoring them, especially if they're kind of out of date or if I'm doing something really important. I need to stay in the zone. So I hate to say it, I haven't really figured it out, but if anyone watching has, please contact me. I would love to be able to find time management tools that really my brain will accept.
Yeah. Contact me too, please, because we can all use those, it sounds like. Lizzie, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Of course, folks can head over to protocol.com to check out your work. But if they want to follow you online, where should they go to do that?
Yeah, they can email me at llawrence@protocol.com. And I'm on Twitter at @LizzieLaw_. Yeah, those are great ways to reach out to me.
Awesome. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Up next, we have Jason Howell's story of the week. And it is a good one today, where we are maybe looking at more protection for our personal data. Before we get to that, though, I'm so excited to tell you about our sponsor today. It's Compiler, which is an original podcast from Red Hat discussing tech topics big, small, and strange. Compiler comes to you from the makers of Command Line Heroes, which I have talked so much about in the past. Love Command Line Heroes. And of course, they were a sponsor on the network. And this one is hosted by Angela Andrews and Brent Simino. Technology can be big, it can be bold and bizarre. It's also complicated. Compiler unravels industry topics, trends, and the things you've always wanted to know about tech through interviews with the people who know it best. On their show, you will hear a chorus of perspectives from the diverse communities behind the code. Compiler brings together a curious team of Red Hatters to tackle big questions in tech, like what is technical debt? What are tech hiring managers actually looking for? And do you have to know how to code to get started in open source? Episode 2 covers what can video games teach us about edge computing? The internet is a patchwork of international agreements and varying infrastructure, but there's something coming to change the ways we connect. In this episode of Compiler, hosts explore what edge computing could mean for people who enjoy video games and what this form of entertainment could teach us about that technology. And episode 9, a really cool one, how are tech hubs changing? Traditionally, if someone wants wanted a career in tech, they had to make the move to a tech hub, which is one of the places near us. It's a city packed with startups and talent. But things are finally starting to change. The hosts of Compiler speak to a few of the change makers who are thinking outside of the physical and social dimensions we've come to associate with innovation. I can't tell you how much, like, the work that Red Hat does in all of its podcasts, in Compiler, in Command Line Heroes, is incredible. The artistry, we're scrolling through the pages right now. If you're listening, you need to go check this out because it is just mind-boggling, the work that they put into these podcasts. And they get these incredible people that you get to hear from. They're not only just these brilliant conversations, but they're so well edited, and there's brilliant music and sound effects, and it just, it's a delight every time. Absolutely worth checking out, and it's very easy to do. You can go to red.ht, think of Red Hat, red.ht/twit, T-W-I-T, red.ht/twit. New episodes are out now. Go and download them at any time, and be sure to check back for new shows when they come out. Listen to Compiler on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to podcasts. We'll also include a link on this episode's show page. And of course, our thanks to Compiler for their support of this show and the entire Twit network. Go there, check it out. You gotta listen to Compiler. All right, back from the break, and it's time for Jason Howell's Story of the Week.
Sometimes I wonder if you got like a song. You've got very, very song
delivery. There are times
delivery.
When I feel I do want to sing and I just spare everyone. And so, yeah.
I like it.
It's a, what is that? It's a sacrifice I make every week for everyone's good.
Well, I like it. If someday it happens, I will be supporting you.
Excellent.
A Senate bill introduced yesterday by Senator Elizabeth Warren could ultimately have a pretty big impact on location and data, health data specifically, sharing and tracking. And so thought we could kind of talk through this a little bit. Obviously, I mean, I personally feel like there's a need for something like this. So I'm happy to see it. At the same time, I'm hopeful but not optimistic that it's going to happen because yeah. It's one of those situations where it seems like one party, the Democrats primarily, are really backing this. And then it seems like the Republicans aren't being very vocal about their support, if they do support it at all. So who knows how far this is going to go. But I think personally, I feel like legislation, something along this line, these lines, needs to exist. It's called the Health and Location Data Protection Act, and it calls out specifically the tracking of location data in apps. So think like weather apps, prayer apps, that sort of stuff. And then the sale of that data after the fact to data brokers or by data brokers. And that's just one example of the kind of behavior that's in its crosshairs. What it's not targeting specifically is tracking of location. It's more tracking of location, tracking of health data, and then sharing that out and then selling that out, right? What happens to that data after the fact?
It's fine for these weather apps, obviously, to gather your location. They
right.
need to. But to actually go out and sell that to someone else afterwards is a problem. And I will say,
it happens so much.
Yes. In fact, data brokers go to, I was just hearing developers talking about this. Data brokers love to track down different developers who make weather apps and specifically offer them money to get that data. Because a person who's using a weather app is going to have their location shared almost always so that they can get the, you know, it's about to rain or today there's going to be a thunderstorm or what have you. So it's really bad.
Totally, totally. That spells it out perfectly right there. Quote from the report or from the bill: data capable of determining the past or present physical location of an individual or an individual's device. So that information is incredibly valuable in this data economy that we live in, right? And this very kind of like uncontrolled, unregulated at this point data economy. Very minimal limitations. It's a pretty sweeping proposal as a result. The Federal Trade Commission, state attorneys general, and even citizens who would be harmed by that kind of a data sell could then sue the brokers behind the violation if this were to pass. The FTC would also receive $1 billion over the next 10 years to enforce the law. But there are a few exceptions. Activities compliant under HIPAA, as well as First Amendment speech. So that would be the exceptions. But really, what you said was exactly it, right? Like all of these apps that, whether we realize it or not, we're using it for a very specific purpose, either to track our health and our activity or our location or whatever, and don't really think about the relationships and the negotiations and arrangements that happen behind the scenes to that data afterwards. And I mean, it's just pervasive. Like this has just been the mobile internet from day one. You know, it's at some point that the data economy found high value in that kind of information, and it's just been going nuts. Now, why now? And it's, you know, it's pretty obvious to see why now. It comes on the heels of a number of reports related to the upcoming and sadly the expected overturn of Roe v. Wade in the Supreme Court. Specifically, just to name one situation here, location data firms like Placer, I think it's Placer, is it Placer? Placer.ai, they were shown to be creating heat maps of the homes of visitors to abortion clinics. That's just Lovely. One example. And so Warren called out the Roe v. Wade leak and the Supreme Court behind it, saying this sort of regulation is needed now more than ever if Roe v. Wade is, you know, removed the way it's expected to be. And data sharing like this is happening behind the scenes, data brokers, you can imagine who's interested in buying that data and what kind of damage could ultimately be done. The consequences are pretty high. So like I already said, though, this is not a prohibition on the tracking of the location itself. It's really what happens to that data afterwards. Because when I was reading this at first, I was like, so wait a minute. Everything that we did, like, what is the app that I use the most? It's like my navigation app, and there's data that's collected there. But also think about, like, what is Google doing with that information? Like, I guess I don't know 100%. When I use navigation in my Maps app, that's data that Google has. That's like intensely granular data that Google has. What does Google then do with that data, that information? Is it selling it out? I don't actually know the answer to that. I'd like to assume that they aren't, but that's the point, right? A lot of this stuff happens behind the scenes. We don't really know. We don't know what the consequences of that is.
It's curious to me why they're going this way with it instead of having the FCC do it, because the FCC already did. I can't remember what the ruling was exactly, but let me see. FCC health apps. Not too long ago, there was
something. Remember that changed? Yes. This was like 2020, maybe.
Yeah. So. It was about protection of data. They had to, protect personal data. They had to have certain protections in place, and if they didn't, then it would make it so that they would have to owe a lot of money. I remember all of that. Mm-hmm. And so if they can do that, all of the stories are just showing the more recent ones, and I'm trying to go back farther. If they could do, watch Scooter X, we'll have it in the chat in like 2 seconds. But if the FCC can do that, then one would think that this would be a great place for the FCC to work, where you don't have to necessarily worry about making it through the legislature and all that kind of stuff, because the FCC's, that's the whole point of that body, is to make sure that... the way that we communicate and all of the communication stuff happens how it's supposed to. I can't find it now, but I remember reading
it. I recall what you're talking about. This was a couple of years ago. God, I can't even remember what it was on the heels of specifically, but it was in reaction to something very specific. So my apologies that I don't have that in my notes.
This was about Congress making this, and I'm the one who brought that up, so that, that's on me. But anyway, my point is, I kind of wish that it had gone through this method, because perhaps then we wouldn't have this, like, will it work, won't it work? Because far as I'm concerned, this is good entirely. This is literally, I mean, in California, we have this protection. If we visit a website with a California IP, somewhere on the page where there's data exchange, there's a link that says, do not share my personal, or do not sell my personal information, because California has laws protecting us in that instance. Mm-hmm. And so that is like, it's already got precedence, first of all. And second of all, this is just very clearly the right thing to do, because a company that is, you know, you've got the argument for Google or Apple or one of these companies, having that granular data makes it so that those services work better. Fine. Use my information in the sort of sandbox of who I am and what I'm trying to do to make that happen. But to actually take all of the stuff that you have about me and sell it to someone, that's a whole different thing that I don't, there's no reason that any company should be doing that. And if your company exists and survives and thrives solely on that income, then I don't care if you go away. I'm sorry, but I don't. I think that you should go away. I think that that company should not exist, because that is information that in so many cases someone doesn't realize that they are losing to a third party.
You know absolutely. What I mean? Absolutely. And, you know, obviously if you're watching the video version, I'm a, you know, a white dude. Like, I have less to sacrifice in a position of in this situation where this data is happening and being shared and sold behind the scenes. There are a lot of examples of how that data sharing behind the scenes allows people with a serious agenda, again, against people who are not white, right, to track and to prevent and them from doing a whole host of things. So, I mean, it's easy to fall into the category of, because you hear this a lot, I have nothing to hide, so I don't care. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why that's faulty thinking, to my opinion.
Yes, I agree.
But for me, as a white dude in the United States of America, like, I've got a heck of a lot of privilege. It's way easier for me to say that about myself than it is for a lot of other people. And so, you know, it's kind of imperative for, I feel like, for people to see beyond that and to say, hey, this might not, you know, have a direct impact to your life. You might not wake up one morning and be like, here's the specific consequence that I am facing because this happens. But that consequence exists for other people. Mm-hmm. And I hope that a law or some sort of regulation around this, like this, can help ease that, can help remove those consequences. Because, yeah, I agree. I feel like this is just too long, kind of gone unregulated, uncontrolled. Mm-hmm. And it's reached a point of extreme, in my opinion.
Yeah, that you're right, Burke. Okay, yeah. I think, okay, FCC, hack, app. Let's see. Data breach. Let's see. FCC data breach notification. That might be what it is. I think that was what it was, where if a company had a data breach, then they had to you're absolutely right. So that's what it was. If health apps and fitness apps had data breaches, then they had to let people know very quickly. And if they didn't, then they would be at a much higher risk of fines and stuff like that. Thanks, Burke. So anyway, in any case, the FCC, I think, would have more teeth in this way, and I kind of wish it was going through there. But maybe, you know, I'm not a law professor, right. So I imagine that there's a reason why they're doing it that way instead. So that makes sense. But I am cheering this bill on for sure when it comes to banning the sale of this data. I think that's a good thing. Let's not let these companies just willy-nilly sell our data. And I mean, they're making money off of us in a way that we have no control over.
Yeah.
And it's just grody.
Yeah. Agreed. Very. All right. So we'll, you know, as that develops, obviously we'll definitely talk about it on this show. But that's my story of the week. Up next, we're going to get to Micah's story of the week, talking a little bit about Activision and harassment claims and what the company is doing behind the scenes about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Melissa. Poor data quality can cost organizations an average of $15 million each year. And the longer poor quality data stays in your system, the more losses you could accumulate. So You want to ensure that your business is successful. Your customer information needs to be accurate as a result. Melissa is the leading provider of global data quality and address management solutions. There's another side to accurate data, of course, and that's customer service. If you address someone with the wrong name, let's say, or you verify the wrong address when you're dealing with an already frustrated customer, tell me all about it. It's going to get awkward, right? And I've even been there. I've been in the receiving end of that. It's not fun. You need Melissa's Identity Solutions. That's Melissa's real-time identity verification service. And this includes identity, ID, and document verification, age authentication, a global watch list screening to establish the identity of a consumer or satisfy AML KYC compliance. You can easily tailor the service to your specific sign-up process and risk management requirements to ensure fast onboarding or e-commerce checkout while protecting your organization against fraud. And if you have Melissa, you're going to reduce risk, you're going to ensure compliance, and keep customers happy. You can protect your data from decay with 2.1 billion clean, validated records. You can ensure compliance in areas of anti-money laundering, politically exposed persons, and Bank Secrecy Act. It's BSA. You can score and target customers with detailed demographic and firmographic data appends, and you can complete customer records. So that's adding things that are missing names, addresses, phone numbers, and email addresses. And all this undergoes independent security audits. They are SOC 2, HIPAA, and GDPR compliant. So you can verify your addresses, your emails, your phone numbers, the names. You can do all that in real time with Melissa. Often at the point of entry, their global address verification service verifies addresses for more than 240 countries and territories at the point of entry. Duplicate information, as you probably already know, it hurts your bottom line. Ultimately, at the end, it hurts your bottom line to have duplicate info in your database. Melissa's data matching is going to help you eliminate clutter and duplicates. That increases the accuracy of your database. That reduces postage and mailing costs. That, you know, ultimately saves you money. Melissa has batch address cleansing. This is a process that goes through an entire address list for accuracy and completeness. You can reduce risk, ensure compliance, and keep customers happy with identity verification. You can convert addresses into lat-long coordinates if you need to with geocoding enrichments. They've got email verification that removes up to 95% of bad email addresses from your databases. Just so much to offer from Melissa, and it's all about cleaning your data and making it the best, most accurate data that it possibly can be. And finally, flexible deployment options. They suit any preference, business size, or budget. They've got flexible on-prem, web service, secure FTP processing, and software as a service delivery options. So after all that, what are you waiting for? Make sure your customer contact data is up to date. Try Melissa's APIs in the developer portal, because it's super easy. You just log on, sign up, and start playing in the API sandbox. You can do that anytime, 24/7. Get started today with 1,000 records clean for free at melissa.com/twit. That's melissa.com/twit. And we thank Melissa for their continued support of Tech News Weekly and the Twit Network. All right, Micah, story of the week time. What you got?
Yes. So this is a new report actually released by Activision Blizzard itself, but it's been picked up by different news places, including Ars Technica. Activision has done an internal investigation of the company. So last November, there was a report published in the Wall Street Journal that talked about Activision's CEO and, in fact, Activision itself kind of being a toxic place to work. The Wall Street Journal report was titled Activision CEO Bobby Kotick knew for years about sexual misconduct allegations at video game giant. So in this piece, they talked about allegations basically that the company knew that there was a lot going on, a lot of harassment going on, and they weren't addressing it. They didn't do anything about it. So since then, there was a lawsuit that was filed by the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing. That was filed in July, this last July. And a bunch of folks kind of coming out and saying, yes, this is an issue. This is something that's going on and it needs to be dealt with. And of course, then Microsoft ended up acquiring or is working on, I can't remember now where they are in that, but Activision Blizzard, you know, being underneath Microsoft. And so, wait, let me, I just want to make sure I get that date right. When that happened. Sorry about that. So yeah, in January of this year, Microsoft agreed to acquire Activision Blizzard. And so, you know, the company is now underneath Microsoft, and they've done an internal investigation. And it's an interesting thing because in the internal investigation, the company filed the report with the Securities and Exchange Commission. And it says that after they concluded their own internal investigation, it says that the results reveal that they, as it says, we are not a company that looks the other way. So as a company, they are saying that in those instances where there was harassment reports, et cetera, we don't look the other way. So they actually worked with external advisors and talked to employees as well. They looked at different notes that existed as part of the suit. And they say, and I quote, "There is no evidence to suggest that Activision Blizzard senior executives ever intentionally ignored or attempted to downplay the instances of gender harassment that occurred and were reported." Now, the company worked with, and let me find this too, the company's internal investigation took place with an advisor called Gilbert Casillas, and Gilbert Casillas is actually the former Equal Employment Opportunity Commission chairman. And so that's who they talked to kind of do this investigation. And this is an interesting quote from Casillas, who says, "Based on the volume of reports, the amount of misconduct reflected is comparatively low for a company the size of Activision Blizzard." So the company has more than 25,000 employees, and the argument here is that in a company with more than 25,000 employees, there will be instances of sexual harassment and all of the concerns there. And they talk about some changes they've made recently. But with that, they say that essentially when people were accused of doing these things and the investigations internally found that they actually did do whatever it was that they were being accused of, then those people were punished, is what the company is claiming. But I want to read this part because this is some of the things that the company is like, hey, look, these are the changes we've made recently. It says they've included zero tolerance policies for harassment and alcohol consumption in the workplace and also at work events. That was a big concern in the past. Waiving arbitration for harassment and discrimination claims, where you work with an arbitrator instead of working directly, you know, with lawyers, and increased investment in anti-harassment and anti-discrimination training and compliance teams. What's unclear to me is how much of this is, Microsoft's own work. Microsoft itself has its own issues, well-known issues with sexual harassment that go all the way up the chain. And so the company, I am the producer of Windows Weekly, and so I listen to the show every week. And Paul Theroux and Mary Jo Foley, who are constantly keeping an eye on Microsoft, they have both mentioned that it is a thing that the company wants to fix, basically, and that they have a lot of focus on that. So to have Activision Blizzard under Microsoft, I'm not surprised that they, you know, have made these changes and that they're working on that. But ultimately, and this is what we don't know yet, because this report was just the filing rather was just published today as we record the show Thursday. I want to know the response that employees have to what's being said and how much of it is
reflecting reality.
Reflecting reality, yeah. Because you're doing your own investigation, and though you may hire an outside source, you are the one hiring that outside source to do it. I don't know anything about that company. I don't know what is their job to look for a possibility of truthfully revealing that there was no issue, or is their job to, without any prior bias, just say what happened.
Well, and there might even be, I mean, I don't know how this industry works, this industry of, you know, company hired to take a look and have a completely unfiltered, unbiased, you know, review of the company. But I have, I mean, I don't know. A part of me feels a little suspicious of a company hiring a company to analyze that.
Yeah.
Not because that company that's hiring the other company says, "And you better not find right. something bad." But there's kind of an inherentness.
Yes. You've been
to
hired
it.
By them.
You've been hired by them.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There's just. I'm not saying that it can't happen.
Right.
I'm not saying that it can't happen right or correctly and done the way that it should be. But I am saying that it's far easier to trust that scenario when the company isn't the one doing the hiring
exactly.
of the other company. You
exactly.
know, it's truly disconnected. And so that's kind of what comes to mind for me. Anytime, and we've heard it, you know, many times before, we've looked into the problem and we've determined that
yeah.
there is no problem,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
coming from the company that
yeah.
has the problem,
yeah,
reportedly.
And I mean,
that never sits well for me.
I can remember all the way back in high school learning how to read science papers published in journals and studies published in journals and learning all there, you know, there's like five or six keywords that you needed to know. And one of those keywords was funding. And you always need to look at who is paying for the study.
Right. Where's the money?
Because
the money
that can
from?
Influence what. And so, yeah, I mean, it's like it's like Boca Bola hiring a set of doctors to come in and say that high sugar sodas are not bad for you. And so if they are hired to find a way to scientifically show that high
bad.
Sugar sodas
right,
are not bad,
right.
then they're not going to come in and show, here's what happens if you drink high sugar sodas
right.
And how it can impact you negatively. And no, they're looking at the ways that it can be, oh, it gives you more energy. Drink another Boca Bola. So yeah, our cells need glucose and your body will absorb this and turn it, you know, so that is something to keep in mind. So anyway, in reading this and hearing about it, I'm definitely reading it with a Himalayan pink sea salt's worth of grain of salt and will eagerly look to the responses of current and former employees as well
yeah.
To this filing that was just filed with the SEC.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree. That gives me a little bit of that suspicious kind of vibe too when I see that. So I'm looking forward to that as well.
Boke Zero.
Yeah, I have no idea what company you were talking about. Boca Bola. No idea.
Never heard of it.
All right, we've reached the end of this episode of Tech News Week. Thank you so much for watching and listening each and every week. We do this show on Thursdays. So if you have subscribed to the podcast, which you really should, that's the way to do it, then you will get it without any effort on your part. You just open up your podcatcher and boom, there's our latest episode waiting for you on a Thursday. And if not, what are you waiting for? Search for us in your podcatcher or go to twit.tv/TNW. That is our show page on the web where you can find all the information you need to do that. You can also watch the episodes on our page. And I know some people do that, but probably not many.
I want to meet you.
Yeah, I want to know why.
Yeah.
But yeah, check it out.
If you'd like to get all of our shows ad-free, we've got a way for you to do that because ads are the way that we support these programs. You listen to the ads and that helps us keep the lights on, helps me make strange names like Boca Bola, etc. But the other way that you can do it is by directly handing over your money. No, directly supporting us, which then would get you no ads. So you can get an ad-free version of every single one of Twit shows by joining Club Twit, twit.tv/clubtwit. For $7 a month, you get every single show ad-free. Super awesome experience of just going right through with all the content. You get access to the members-only Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else, including outtakes, behind the scenes, the book club that just took place this morning, lots of fun stuff there, and access to the members-only Discord server. That is a place where you can go and chat with your fellow Club Twit members, but also those of us here at Twit as well. It's a super active community and lots of fun places to chat, lots of channels about different categories. And you'll find your people there. Indeed. If that sounds good to you, twit.tv/clubtwit to check it out. And we've got an increasingly growing audience who are supporting shows directly through Apple Podcasts. So if you use Apple Podcasts and you want to support the show and get an ad-free version of the audio feed, well, it's a pretty simple thing to do. All you do is in Apple Podcasts, type in Tech News Weekly, you find us, and you'll see a button that says subscribe for $2.99. When you subscribe and pay that $2.99 a month, you will get the ad-free version of the audio feed of Tech News Weekly. And that works for all of the shows, so you can check those out as well. If you'd like to follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent on many a social media network. You can head to chihuahua.coffee, chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. And of course, check me out this Saturday for the radio show heard around the world. It is The Tech Guy, which I record with Leo Laporte, where we take questions, tech questions, and answer those for you. And on Tuesdays for iOS Today, where we talk all things iOS, tvOS, watchOS, etc., with Rosemary Orchard. It's a great time. And Jason Howell, what about you?
I was just thinking, it should be Tech Guys, right?
Tech Guys, yeah.
Tech Guys on Saturdays.
Tech Guys, yeah.
Tech Guys on Saturdays. At Jason Howell on Twitter. That's where you can find me doing my social thing. And then also All About Android every Tuesday, twit.tv/AAA, where we talk about horses. just kidding. Got you. We talk about Android. Thanks to John Ashley, stood up out of his chair, what are you doing? Thank you, John Ashley, for being so concerned and everything else you do with the show. Thank you to Burke for testing everyone and working behind the scenes to make this show possible. And thanks to you. Yeah, you. I'm talking to you. I'm also pointing at you. I'm probably, don't be offended by that, but I mean it. You're awesome. Thank you for watching and listening. We couldn't do this show without you. We'll see y'all next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Did you spend a lot of money on your brand new smartphone and then you look at the pictures on Facebook and Instagram and you're like, what in the world happened to that photo? Yes, you have. I know. It happens to all of us. Well, you need to check out my show, Hands-On Photography, where I'm going to walk you through simple tips and tricks that are going to help make you get the most out of your smartphone camera or your DSLR or mirrorless, whatever you have. And those shots are going to look so much better, I promise you. So make sure you're tuning in to twit.tv/hop for Hands-On Photography to find out more.